This Week in Retronauts, I'll show you mine if you show me yours. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Retronauts. I am Jeremy Parrish, and I am, as always, incredibly tasteless. And this is an episode that has been a year in the making, because one of the people here on this very recording, not in this very room, because it's all remote, but we kicked around this idea and brainstormed it and sort of came up with it together last year at PAX East 2025, and it has been a week now since PAX East 2026. That's how long it's been. Sometimes things are slow, but you know what? Video game history is not going away. It's just out there for us to talk about at our leisure. And actually, it's kind of good in a way. Maybe it's actually very bad that we waited so long on this topic, because it's somehow there's a lot of resonance with the present day, and it makes me sad, but it's good radio. So anyway, this is episode, let me see what that says, 763, and there's a whole bunch of people here, so I'm going to stop talking and let them introduce ourselves. I guess we should start with the person who is responsible for me making this happen. Even if, I don't know, John, do you remember this happening? Please introduce yourself and bear witness.
Of course I remember this happening. We've been talking about it for a while. And hey, everybody, this is John Anderson. I am a video game historian and game industry consultant. You can find me talking about video game history on my social media feeds on X at John Anderson 21 on X, and also on Blue Sky at johnanderson.bsky.social.
John, I've got to say, your speaking voice is much deeper than your singing voice. I'm sure you're sick of that joke. Let's see. Let's go on to our other guest of honor this episode, someone who is not normally a Retronaut, calling in from Japan, very relevantly.
Are you talking about me, Bachelor number
That's you.
Two?
That's you.
So, by the way, congratulations on episode 763. You do not look a day over 762.
Thank you.
I wanted to say that. I am Matt Ault. I am the author of a book called Pure Invention, How Japan Made the Modern World, and oh, how relevant it is to what we're going to be talking about today.
Yes, so looking forward to getting into it. Sure as heck is. Yes, it's one of those. This is one of those episodes gets more and more relevant the further and further away we get from that point in history, which is weird, but it's how it happens.
Well, you know, it's like they say, history doesn't repeat, it rhymes.
Yeah, it's like poetry. So could we get the other person calling in from Japan to speak up and introduce themselves?
Showa 51er, Diamond Fight. Hello, everybody.
And also batting cleanup.
It's Kevin Bunch, and I really liked that Showa 51 joke. I really should have thought of that myself for my own year. Oh, well.
We're like Showa 100 now, you know. We're like Showa 101 or 102 or something like that. I don't even.
I feel funny. Like the Japanese Reiwa Emperor would not be pleased with that.
No, actually, it's funny. Calendars in Japan, like if you get a paper calendar, many times they will have a Showa notation on it too, and also a Heisei one. So it's like the counters keep going in some sense, even though they're not like literally used anymore. So I was really shocked to see there's actually like, oh, it's Showa 100 and whatever. the most recent calendar we opened.
Yeah, weird. It's the calendar year equivalent of 11-teen.
Yeah, something like that.
So yes, that's what we're talking about. We keep saying the word Showa because this is the first episode in a series about gaming trends and history in Japan. And you might think, oh, you talk about that a lot, Retronauts, but this is really more of a primer. Gosh, it's been so long since we discussed this entire concept and came up with it that I'm actually a little fuzzy on what it's supposed to be about. So we'll kind of pick that up and figure it out next time we record. But for the moment, what I'd like to do is talk about how eras in Japanese calendar notation really shape culture and talk about video gaming in the Showa era. But that's the Showa era lasted a long time. So we're going to talk specifically about the 1970s, which then gives us the 1980s, and very conveniently for everyone except Hirohito, Showa ended at the very end of the 80s for the rest of the calendar world, the world's calendar. So it's a pretty nice clean break there. So this is going to take us up through 1978. I'm calling this episode The Journey to Space Invaders because that's really where a lot of the Japanese games industry and people, chroniclers and historians and journalists and, the people who throw Tokyo Game Show every year kind of start. Like, video games didn't exist in Japan before Space Invaders, but they're wrong, and we're going to talk about that. But first, before we do that, I have called in the expert, Matt Alt, to talk about what the hell does Showa mean? And what was Japanese culture like? Like, what was history happening leading up to the advent of video games in Japan? It's a big topic, so take your time, ruminate.
Famously, Japan didn't exist before 1978 when Space Invaders arrived. It was just a figment in the imagination of the West. No, I'm just kidding. Showa is, of course, the name for an era. And as you said, it is it's generally considered custom in Japan that emperors or their people pick a name to describe their reign. And Showa describes the theme, whatever you want to call it. It means Showa, it's like shining peace, which is kind of ironic given what we're going to get into in a moment here. But it refers to one Emperor Hirohito's reign, which began in 1926 and lasted until his death in 1989. And one of the reasons that the Showa era is so romanticized in Japan, even though it does contain some pretty low points, is because it almost perfectly maps to Japan's rise and fall as a post-war economic power. In fact, it actually contains two rises and falls, you could say, from 1926 until in the 1940s, when Japan was on the rise as an imperial power in the Pacific, and then the epic crash, you could say, as it lost World War II, then the epic rise after World War II, really epic. By 1960, it became like the world's second largest economy, and then equally epic crash right after Emperor Hirohito died in 1989. 1990 is the start of Japan's lost decades, when the bubble economy went kablooey, I believe is what the economists say. And things got pretty dark for Japan for a while. So that's historically speaking, this is the era we're talking about. And I think we should be clear absolutely here that when we say that we romanticize this era or we look back fondly on it, we're mainly talking about the post-war stuff. We are not talking about the erosion of democracy, the rise of fascism, the invasion of neighboring countries on all sorts of trumped up, did I just say that or think it, pretexts. And then all of the destruction, chaos, sadness, and loss that ensued from World War II. Bad, I think we can all agree on that part, to put it into a little box. But the post-war stuff is really fascinating and interesting. So.
Yes, and that is really what's relevant. We don't need to talk about World War II here. We're not getting into Call of Duty for a long time. Or Medal of Honor, I guess. Yeah, okay. Anyway, it's really kind of the reincarnation, from the ashes of Japan in the 1950s and 60s that really lays the ground for so much of the video gaming industry. When you sit down and you look at the history of video games, I mean, yes, they were invented in America, and it was at American universities and corporations, and they were the ones driving it. But so much of the shape of the video games industry and the business in the early days and really beyond were tied to innovations coming from Japanese firms and from partnerships with Japanese firms. So many Japanese manufacturers were fundamentally essential to the early days of video games and providing the technology and equipment and just the things that made video games go video. Diamond.
I just want to explain a little bit here, just for the era purposes. It's something that sort of dominates Japanese culture in a way that's hard to explain until you live here on a regular basis. Because if you visit here, it's not really a big deal. But when you live here, you have to know dates based on what era they came from. Like, I was born in the Showa era, and when I fill out forms, I have to fill out, like, my birth date often in the Showa format.
Yes.
And my kids were born in Heisei, so they have Heisei date. Like, I know my kids' birthdays backwards and forwards, but whenever I fill out a form, like, oh, what Heisei year were you? I can't remember what, you know, like, that kind of stuff, you know, vexes me all the time. And in fact, now we're living in a Reiwa, which is the third era that, you know, of recent memory. And it's just, it's so much to consider. Also, the fact that the Showa era is, I believe, the longest era ever, because Hirohito took the throne at a very young age because his father just wasn't up to it, and he died.
Yeah, it was the Queen Elizabeth II of Japanese eras.
Yeah,
totally.
Yeah, very, very good analog. Except, but it's like, imagine if in the UK they literally explained
all the way down
everything
to the disappointing sons.
They literally explain everything. Oh, what year is it? It's Elizabeth 42 or Elizabeth 67. Like, that's what happens here. Everything is talked about in terms of years. And especially on Japanese television, which I am an unwilling viewer nightly, they love Showa. And also, I should specify, this is Showa, S-H-O-W-A, not S-H-O. A-H, nothing to do with the Holocaust here. Showa. Wow.
Oh, God, I never even thought about that connection. Good, good. I like these clarifications. This is good.
Because they love talk about Showa songs versus Heisei songs, or Showa celebrities versus Heisei celebrity. They love comparing this stuff, much like American media these days loves talk about, like, Gen X and Gen Z and millennials and Zoomers and stuff that I do not understand, and I'm okay with that. Like, in Japan, they very clearly have, okay, well, this is the Showa era, and this is the Heisei era, and they love to compare these things. So, yeah, last year, which was technically Showa 100, they did all kinds of TV specials about, oh, it's 100 years of Showa, what happened during the Showa era, and, whoa, no, don't talk about that part of the Showa era. No, let's talk about this part of the Showa era, the 60s and 70s and 80s, the fun stuff, and, you know, like Godzilla and Kaiju and stuff, like, you know.
Oh, yeah.
They love that, and they don't really talk about beginning part of the Showa, because let's be honest, no one likes to relive that, except we're living it right now.
Or the Emperor. Really, nobody. I don't think any of this love is about the Emperor. But, you know, no. It's interesting. It's all about pop culture. And I just wanted to add something to what you were saying, Jeremy. The technology exchange is really important, but equally, if not more important, during that post-war Showa era is the cultural exchange. Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right that the roots of games can be traced back there, but so can the roots of things like karaoke. So can the roots of things like manga. Like, you have all sorts of people, like, ranging from government officials to enlisted men, bringing, they have to live here as part of the occupation of Japan, and they're bringing all sorts of stuff with them. And that is most Japanese people's first real interaction with American culture.
Right. I've got a little pamphlet here that my parents just sent me. This was my grandfather's. He was stationed in Japan after World War II, during the occupation and reconstruction. And this is just like this old, old pamphlet called Notes on Japanese Cuisine.
Oh, but wow.
I feel like it's so emblematic of that era where there was this cultural exchange. I don't know if you can see this photo, but it's like, you know, white American men in suits and women wearing kimono. And they're all just like sitting around table eating shabu shabu or yakiniku, yes, or something, and smiling. Wow. And they're just having a great time. And yeah, like, this is a very heartwarming little book for me. I realize that, you know, the circumstances in which it was created were not best, but, you know, definitely, it does speak to the way, after all the conflict and the horrors that happened between these two countries, after all of that was settled, it was just like this very quick friendship and this, you know, this back and forth. And obviously Americans took a lot over there at the time, but they brought so much back.
Yes. And also, it wasn't just, you know, I know the white people are lionized in these images, but there were a lot of black enlisted men. They brought things like jazz that took off here. Famously, it was a black serviceman who gave Osamu Tezuka his stash of American comics. So, like, there's all of this really interesting stuff happening culturally going on there. And, yeah, it is a moment in U.S.-Japan relations. And I think one of the reasons it went so well is because average Japanese didn't vote for the war in the Pacific. It was completely, like, top-down. There wasn't, I mean, I'm sure there was nationalism and xenophobia and things like there always are, but this wasn't some kind of, hey, this was a great idea from the entire country. And when it was over, people felt an incredible sense of relief. And I think it was also a big smart move on the part of the American government, GHQ, that they staffed the occupation mainly with people who had never fought the Japanese in the Pacific Theater. It was mainly people from Europe or from the States. And so there wasn't a lot of animosity on the soldiers' side either. This was all like kind of new experiences to all sides. So it was a very, very tumultuous era, but it did give birth and rise to a lot of things that we kind of take for granted today.
Exactly.
The end. The end. I'm sorry. I should have continued that more.
No, but, it's fine.
No, I mean, I could keep talking about this forever, but like, if you want to see how bad things were at this point, you could watch the movie, for instance, Godzilla Minus One, which is a very romanticized portrait, a very sentimentalized portrait of this era. But you can see how Tokyo and Osaka and other big cities, it's set in Tokyo, but were basically shanty towns. At that immediate post-war era, there was very few things standing, and any major buildings were basically taken over by the Americans. And in fact, Japan didn't exist as a country. It was America. It had like a zip code. It was an American-occupied territory, and that wouldn't change until 1952. So some pretty, you know, hairy times for the Japanese people right after the war, and things, as we know, went well because things started really exploding in the 60s, 70s, and 80s.
There is a whole bunch of notes that have been added to the notes, the outline that I put together that I did not see until just now, talking about pachinko. Was that you, Matt?
That was me.
No, I didn't. Pachinko is important. Pachinko is really important. Yeah.
I was just thinking like the TR-55 transistor radio that Sony created, but there's so much more here. If you want to, I'm just going to let you walk us through this because I know you're kind of on a time crunch, so you can't be here for the whole episode. So I'd say, Make your moments count, Matt.
Oh, sure. But if Kevin added the pachinko stuff, I'm sure Kevin wants to talk about pachinko.
That's
right?
True. I did add that.
Oh,
stuff.
Sorry. I missed that.
But go on because it's great stuff. I mean, pachinko is important. It definitely leads into the electromechanicals and all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Pachinko, you know, I don't want to call it the national game of Japan, but as far as coin-op goes, it kind of was the starter one. Coin-op games, they were introduced to Japan pretty early on after the company opened up in the Meiji era, late 1800s. It really took off around 1924 when Bagatelle came over there. They called it Pachi Pachi because it was primarily like a kid's game. If you've never experienced Bagatelle, and, you know, who has really, unless you're a coin-op enthusiast. But it's basically like a horizontal board, like pinball, except there's no flippers. You're just like plunging in the ball and it's bouncing around a bunch of pins on the field. And eventually it drains out once it gets to the bottom.
You're really selling me on this.
Yeah.
I think I've seen that in Shinsekai down in Osaka. I think they call it something like Powerball, though, or something. Like, they might use a different name, but I've definitely seen these devices still in the wild. Yes.
Yeah, so this eventually turned into pachinko because in Japan, because their space is at a premium in a lot of these shops and gaming areas, they mounted them vertically. And lo and behold, now you have pachinko. They became associated with gambling pretty quickly, as they still are. Mm-hmm. And they kind of continued on through the 30s as like an industry until 1937, when the government had production halted on coin-op machines because they were at war with China. Again, not something anyone really wanted to do, including the people in Tokyo. And then that followed up with them closing the pachinko parlors in 1938, because their argument was that leisure activities, luxury items, these were a distraction.
More than that, the enemy. It's Zaitaku Atekida. So, like, yeah, like, anything, any leisure is the enemy. What a wonderful time.
Yeah, yeah. No parallels whatsoever.
God.
But after the war ended, 1946, pachinko, you know, production started back up. It actually became sort of a way for people to, like, kind of gamble to win prizes like soap or vegetables, stuff you couldn't really readily get because of all the shortages. And there was a designer, his name was Shoichi Masamura. He was the one who came up with ideas to add to pachinko, such as having spinners on the board to, like, bounce the balls around, or having ways that you could have a bunch of balls, like, get shot into the play field. Very common aspects of pachinko nowadays, but had to start somewhere. And this because this became so popular, the government started regulating it around 1954, and they sort of tamped it down to where it was, which should say something about where it was. But they didn't really have... Oh, go ahead.
No, I was going to say it's... There's this... I don't want this to turn into an episode about pachinko, but really, like, it's difficult to understate how much of a kind of resonance there is between pachinko and video games later on. You know, it established an idea that you would put in a coin and get some kind of leisure out of it. It also established the fact that basically the gangsters are controlling these spaces. They are cash in, cash out businesses. They are real estate. These are all great ways to bring out money without reporting all of it to the authorities. In fact, there's a great movie in the 80s, from the 80s called A Taxing Woman, that deals a lot with, in the very opening of the first movie, deals with a tax investigator who is basically cracking down on a pachinko parlor. And the early video games, like, everybody points to Space Invaders, but really the first boom for video games in Japan was Breakout, Brokuzushi, as they called it in Japan. Those places were competing not for kids' mindshare, but for the mindshare of pachinko players when they came out in the 70s. 100% competing with pachinko. Very quickly, the gangsters realized that this was something interesting, you know, to them, not only in competition, but interesting to do. And this is why, and I'll promise I'll make this the end thought on this, many, many, many of the video game companies that we now love had deep associations with criminal organizations in the 80s in particular. And now that's not so much the case, but it would be shocking, and I'm not going to name names, and I'm not going to say who or where or when, but there is a lot, and I mean a lot, of hanky-panky going on in the video game industry of the late 70s and 80s.
I've heard some stories.
Oh, yeah.
Diamond?
Yeah, I just want to add here, along with all the other stuff that grew out of the post-war era and the Reconstruction era, we should also quickly mention the fact that also was a booming time for the black marketers and, in turn, the Yakuza. So if you watch any of your classic Yakuza cinema, they usually tend to start with at least a scene or two during the post-war era when everyone's, like, scrounging for food or, you know, essentials, and it's like, oh, well, here's this guy, he's got all the stuff, and he'll help you get it if you do him a favor, and then all of a sudden that goes and balloons into that. And just the pachinko and video game connection is, I feel like it's so strong because even today, where I feel like pachinko is slowly dying, it's slowly dying, I feel, largely because the players who grew up with it are themselves literally dying. But even though...
Sorry, that's not funny. I shouldn't laugh about that.
It's a fact. I'm trying to keep it straight here. But the fact that there still is a strong connection and there still are new pachinko games coming out that are often, you know, branded with or associated with classic video games, because that's the market now. Someone who played, you know, someone who played video games in the 80s and 90s is now, you know, 30 or 40 or 50 years old, and maybe now they're curious about pachinko, and, oh, well, there's a video game I recognize, I'll go in there and I'll play a pachinko machine that looks like a video game I remember when I was a kid. They still do this, and there's still all this happening, even though pachinko as a whole... You know, I've seen it certainly in the time that I've been here, and I'm sure, Matt, you've seen it even more because you've been here longer than I have. Like, it's just not as big as it once was, but it's still there. It's still clinging on. And that's a reflection of how big it was. Yeah.
Very profitable. And actually, I remember, you know, I worked for many years as a localizer. So I was doing a lot of business. My company was doing a lot of business with Japanese game companies. And I remember in like the teens, the 2010s, like pachinko suddenly became the most profitable thing that a lot of game companies were doing. All sorts of game companies jumped into it. Like I know Konami was doing it. Many others were doing it. And it was probably more profitable for them than making the games that we associate those companies with. And even today, it's still hugely, like, it's dying, but it's like, I would die for 1% of the revenues that these things are making. I mean, it's still making huge sums of money. You know, how much of that money is like legal money? How much of that is like hanky panky? But I wanted to just say, Kevin said something really, really interesting, which I, you know, it's funny. I hadn't even connected, but it makes perfect sense. As an outsider looking at pachinko, you're like, why are these prizes so lame? It's like the equivalent of like a Chuck E. Cheese, like what you're exchanging tickets for, but for adults. It's like a rice cooker. It's like soap. It's like shampoo. But Kevin is absolutely right. That is a link to the black market era when that stuff would have been, you know, winning a pound of sugar at pachinko or something would have been absolutely game changing for a lot of families back then. Now it's just like, you know, it's a kind of fig leaf for the fact that most people trade their tokens or their medals or whatever for money, but. Yeah. So anyway.
Yeah. I remember there was an issue, a story in Meizani Koku where Kyoko gets pissed off and goes and plays pachinko to like burn off some rage. And she walks home with just like arms full of cat food. And I was like, what the hell is that? I have no idea. Like, then later I learned like, this is why they give you dumb, stupid, crappy prizes. It's because you're supposed to walk around to the building, you know, behind in the alley and trade it for cash. Oh, now I get it. So she was just like going home with the cat food instead of trading it in.
Can we also talk about another aspect of these, which is of pachinko parlors, is that they were regulated as adult-only spaces. Mm-hmm. They didn't want kids in them, you know, for obvious reasons. They didn't want students in them. And that actually comes – that's another overlap with video games because in the early 80s, there was a huge amount of pushback against video games from PTAs, you know, and other sorts of organizations. And they successfully lobbied the Japanese government to regulate or to not to regulate, but to I guess, mark, what do you call it, arcades as adult spaces that kids could not go into. And so suddenly you had, I think Japan is actually the first nation on the planet that passed at the governmental level any kind of regulation affecting video games. Other places, America had like little localized things, like you're in, you know, middle of nowhere, Texas, and we're banning video games from this township, but you never had anything national. Japan did. And that would actually go on to have some really interesting implications because by banning kids from arcades, suddenly you're compelling them to play at home. Who happens to have the best video game system on the planet in 1984 or 5 when this is happening?
Epic, right?
Somebody, yep.
Yes. It's a Super Cassette Vision.
Yes. I think, Sega don't what Nintendo did at that. Am I making this up? At that point in history.
Kids were not gravitating toward the SG-1000, it's true.
No, they were not. They were absolutely not.
No, that's an observation that you've made before. I think maybe in your book. Or maybe some of your blog posts.
Yes.
And I've picked that up and just plagiarized it. No, I credit you.
Please. But I mean, it's meant to be used.
The timing
please.
On that, like I looked up the legislation and how that shook out, and it coincides almost exactly with the arrival of third parties on Famicom, which was where suddenly the system was not just like, hey, here is a game from Nintendo once every couple of months, but all of a sudden, like, there was this flood of recognizable arcade games like Pac-Man and Zevius and Galaxian, like stuff kids wanted to play, and they couldn't play it at arcades anymore. So all of a sudden, like, Namco was there saying, here's something that's actually almost kind of an arcade-perfect version of Pac-Man, and kids said, oh my God, yes, let's do that. And so it was just a lot of factors lining up, like the stars all aligning for Nintendo at that moment, in ways that I don't think anyone could have predicted. But we're getting into part two of the show.
We are. Yes. Let's stick with part one. So let's move the clock back to that kind of pachinko era, because another thing that comes into play here are transistors, which Sony did not invent. Sony famously sent its, or its founder, Masaru Ibuka, went to Bell Labs and checked out their, like, kind of prototype transistors. And American companies were making transistor radios, or trying to at the time. But it was Sony who managed to, in very Japanese fashion, make transistors mass producible. And this was actually a huge, huge breakthrough, because the original American transistor radios were very fragile. They're very expensive, because, like, you can only use like 2 out of every 10 or whatever transistors that came off the line. And the Sony's research into transistors was so profoundly transformative that their head engineer, Leo Esaki, went on to win the Nobel Prize in Physics for the work that he had conducted at the Sony labs on transistors. And it's not like for the it's for some like really obscure, you know how these Nobel Prizes work, but it all came out of that. And so, you know, transistors are obviously another big element of the whole rise of gaming.
Yeah, I have read that transistors are the most manufactured item in human history.
Yes.
With some trillions of them having been created over the past basically 70 years. And for maybe it's actually worth explaining what the hell a transistor is, because, you know, it's something we just take for granted now. And it is kind of hard, if you don't understand what the technology was before that, to really grasp what a landmark, basically an earthquake of technology that just like completely transformed the entire landscape. Because before transistors, tiny little transistors, just these little guys, you had to use vacuum tubes to power your machines.
Oh, and they
and
suck.
Those were massive. They were fragile. They were not solid state.
They were hot.
Very expensive, and they generated so much heat and consumed so much power that they wasted converting just into, you know, radiating heat, as opposed to using them for calculations. A transistor.
So you
takes,
mean like AI? Like AI
yeah,
server
exactly.
farms?
Exactly. Yes. Just pure waste. Except, you know, more fragile, I guess.
Yes.
And it couldn't make photos of people look like plastic. So, you know, that's an advantage for AI.
If only AI could burn out as often as a vacuum tube did.
Well, don't worry. The corporations are headed that way. So all of a sudden, you know, something that cost inordinate amounts of money, required massive amounts of space, generated so much heat, required so much maintenance, and, you know, just so much personnel on hand to perform even simple calculations. All of a sudden, that could be done in something almost too small to see. Like, you know, the early transistors were bigger than that, but it made a huge, huge difference to technology, and made miniaturization, portability, scale, consumer manufacturing, you know, just everything possible. Like, it was that revolutionary an invention. Maybe the most important invention of the 20th century. I don't know. It's
absolutely no. I think so. Absolutely. And everybody knew it too. This is the interesting thing. Like, people knew the transistor era was coming. When I was doing research for my book, there was a period in the late 50s, early 60s, where you called like really chipper, you know, bright women transistor girls, as opposed to like party girls or hippie girls or something like that. It was like, it was really a word back then. Like, we used cyber in the 90s, like, you know, AI is used now, you know, all of this streaming, like, it was the word back then. And Sony basically did not have a monopoly on it, but they, you know, they had a way of doing things that was arguably better than the way other people did. And quickly other Japanese companies sort of copied that. And that's where you have the first boom, post-war boom in like the late 50s. We had just been fighting Japan. We had just been fighting them. And now everybody wants Japanese transistor radios. It was like a Pokemon craze for adults. Everybody wanted one of these things.
If you go back and read early issues of Iron Man, He is always talking about the transistors in his armor. Like, that is his thing. He's like, transistor, transistor, transistor. It was a big deal. Like, he didn't have to fly around with, you know, vacuum tubes.
Right,
like
exactly.
An entire room behind him on his shoulders. He had transistors. He was Iron Man, damn it.
More like Silicon Man, right?
Oh, my God.
And, you know, a lot of the early video games, they used transistor logic. Like, those boards are a lot of transistor logic chips. So,
yeah, isn't Space Invaders is all, like, is there any software? It's, like, hard.
Space Invaders was the first microprocessor, like, software game made in Japan.
So, Breakout,
for
then.
Arcade.
Breakout is all transistors, then.
Yes.
I guess that makes sense because famously, wasn't it the whole Steve Jobs, Steve Wozniak thing was that Jobs was working at Atari and Nolan Bushnell, who is like the original, he is like the original Silicon Valley, like wunderkind. Like nobody gives him the credit now for being like, he's like high flying, champagne sipping and quote unquote, the smell of marijuana freely circulating through the vents at Atari. Ooh.
He was the original Ehrlich Bachman.
Yes, he was definitely.
You call him a little sleazy. It's okay. He's got like Carnival Barker energy.
Oh, for sure, God! But he gave a bounty to anybody who could reduce the number of transistors in like redesigning Breakout because like each one of those cost money, man. And Jobs said he could do it, and of course he couldn't. But his buddy Wozniak could. And there's that whole famous story where Jobs takes the bounty and then only gives Wozniak like a little tiny percentage of it and uses the rest to go on like a tour of enlightenment in India with it instead or something like that. But transistors.
And then Wozniak's design was so elegant and so refined that it was like impossible to manufacture. So yes, they had to redo it anyway.
Sort of.
But yeah, I think wasn't the first transistor-based video game of any kind? Wasn't that Western Gun, which was an adaptation of a Taito game?
Oh, Transistor? Microprocessor?
Or Microprocessor, sorry.
Yeah. One of them, Gunfight, that was based Gunfight, on Western Gun, yeah.
Okay, yeah. Which was Transistor in Japan, made by Tomohiro Nishikado. But when Midway brought it over, they said, oh, let's redo this whole thing as a microchip.
Yes, and because Dave Nutting Associates, which was one of their, like, Skunk Works developers they worked with, had just put together this, like, microprocessor-based development board, they were the ones who got tapped to put this together, and they basically just redid the whole game in a way that Nishikado hated, but
nice,
worked out really well in the U.S. market.
Just for, I suspect anybody who's listened this far already knows, but Mr. Nishikado is the gent who designed Space Invaders. So, and other
which
games,
which is the
course.
Cutoff point for this episode.
Okay, see ya. Bye. No, I. I know. Darn.
But he is all over the early Taito game stuff too. So it wasn't just that he like rolled in and did Space Invaders. Like all of their like video game stuff prior to that point, and some of their electromechanical, he was involved in it.
We should talk about those EMs a little bit, very briefly, because they are the precursors. You know, all of these guys, Namco, you know, the electromechanical games, which featured, I mean, these are analog par analog, you know, it's like they would have like film strips and like models like and all sorts of like physical things. They're like physical video games. Isn't that how you describe them?
They're pretty cool.
Yeah, they are. They're amazing. And they made quite a bit of money. But they were, you know, giant contraptions full of gears, you know, magic, like all sorts of stuff happening, very difficult to maintain. And I think it's interesting. Most of these game companies in Japan got their start doing distribution and repair of things like jukeboxes, electromechanical games. And only after that did they get kind of into the business of making games. Or maybe they didn't even have that. Like Nintendo just kind of jumped into it. You know, in the 70s with Laser Clay, which was another big kind of game experience of the 70s that gave us the rudiments, I guess you might say, of the light gun, the Nintendo light gun. And Sonny Chiba wielding it.
And also brings us to a parallel with the present day. But go ahead, John.
Well, I just have to jump in with what Matt was talking about with regards to jukeboxes, because a lot of game developers that would go on, game making companies that would go on to become huge hits in the arcades and producing games for Nintendo and Sega and other companies actually got their start in jukebox rental and repair businesses. Konami in Osaka, they started out as a jukebox rental and repair business in Osaka. Nichibutsu, also in Osaka, famous for Crazy Climber and several other shooting games, they got their start off as a jukebox rental business. And then you have Sega in Tokyo. They got their start by importing Rockola jukeboxes from Chicago. And that just blew up. Sega's ability in the mid-1960s, well, throughout the 1960s, to establish itself like right down the street from the Tokyo airport, Tokyo Haneda Airport, and import jukeboxes from Chicago, it was a huge, huge success to them. And what it allowed for them to do was it allowed Sega and Rockola to visit one another to see how they worked with regards to the research and development departments. And jukeboxes were in high demand. They went in bowling alleys, bars, hotels, inns, Japanese onsens. Just a major money earner, which helped really kickstart a lot of these companies into getting into electromechanical games.
Yeah, and this was really, you can go ahead if you want.
Well, I'll just real quick, I'd say, and also, you know, jukeboxes gave us basically the karaoke machine. Jukebox, the karaoke technology is based a lot on, and there even were jukeboxes that had microphones attached to them that were mainly used for like emceeing, not for actually singing over. But the people who initially invented jukeboxes initially invented the karaoke machine were definitely looking at jukeboxes as one of their inspirations for doing it. So this is like another example of how, you know, all of this kind of cross-pollination is happening. And then speaking of Rockola, didn't they make one of my favorite games as a kid, Eyes? A terrible Pac-Man clone where you're shooting, like, it's just an eyeball going around like a maze. It's horrific. I loved it. anyway, yes.
Classic. I was just going to say that it's very fascinating to me that, like, jukeboxes really blew up and karaoke and everything. Because this was another example of sort of that cultural exchange between the U.S. and Japan. Because, you know, early on, there wasn't a lot of money floating around for like leisure activities, right? So it wasn't until the Korean War started and you had all these American troops getting stationed in Japan that there was even like an economic base to have coin-op amusements other than pachinko. And this really fed in because once Japanese civilians suddenly had more money to throw around in the late 50s, you know, there was a pipeline that had already been established just from these bases.
For sure. And I think it's also really important to note something here that, like, Tokyo of the, you know, it goes without saying of the immediate post-war era when everything was destroyed, but Tokyo of the 60s was not the Tokyo of today. It was not a place with a lot of leisure activities going on. It was a thriving city. It had been largely, not entirely, but largely rebuilt. But pretty much, if you were a young person living in Tokyo in the 1960s, your only outlets were drinking, reading manga, sex, or pachinko. And, like, I'm not actually joking. Like, these are, and like, drinking was actually number one. Like, when they would ask people what your hobbies are outside of work, drinking is number one. Like, reading manga is number two. And that's where you have the rise in the 60s of manga, not for kids, but these lurid, hard-boiled manga, gekiga for adults, and all sorts of crossovers.
You couldn't get sex in real life, there was always gekiga.
Exactly. And it was a societal problem a lot of people saw at the time, but now it's like, that's the roots of another huge aspect of Japanese pop culture, which is like all of its illustrated entertainments. And it wouldn't be until the early 1970s when the laws restricting Western companies from investing or opening businesses were lifted, that you started to see an influx of places like fast food restaurants. You saw the early convenience stores. You saw things like Shakey's, which is so, so important to the Pure Tokyo Scope podcast with Patrick Macias and I. You saw all sorts of these things come in. And that is really, you know, in confluence with a growing leisure, a growing middle class in Japan. Young people who are highly educated, they're starting to make money. They're looking for things to do. So you have pachinko, you have all of these places to go, you have video games coming into the mix, and that like kind of paves the way for the 80s, which is the kind of modern Tokyo as we know it. Bustling, crazy, wild, all sorts of brands and things like that.
I'm sorry, Matt, you're just blowing my mind here. So is that why in the early 70s you had in such short order KFC arrives, McDonald's arrives, Mr. Donut officially from Boston arrives, and like those are now mainstays of Japan. They all arrive because some law. Oh, wow. I did not know that. Okay.
Yes, yes, yes. Wow. And the funny thing is, many of them survive here and they don't in the States. 7-Eleven is not an American company anymore. Mr. Donut is now, he should be like a Lord Donut now. I think he is like risen. He has risen in the hierarchy here. Mr. Donuts are everywhere. The last time I remember seeing a Mr. Donut in America, I think I was in elementary school. I haven't seen one in years. Shakey's is basically gone. Mm-hmm. Like the big boy chain of restaurants is here.
I was just about to say big boy. I think Denny's is a little more Denny's, relevant in Japan now.
We're going way off track here, but it's just so funny. Somebody on social media in Japan like went and visited a Denny's in America, and they're like, oh my God, this is different. I just ate more sugar in one sitting than I have in a week in Japan. This is amazing. Why so can't much we have worse. This? Well, no, it was like, why he was posting it like, why can't we have nice things? And I'm like, dude, you got no idea how good you got it. Okay, I'm just gonna say it.
Wow. Okay.
Anyway, yeah. So yes, that's the reason.
Always greener. And don't forget Toys R Us still over
and
there.
Toys R Us, yes. Although I hear they're coming back in the States now.
I'm sure there. It's like the some sort of weird Revenant version.
whatever one pops up here, I'll let you know. I'll
please
I'll see what my kid thinks.
I don't know how much of my childhood I spent in that. Like, I can still smell the video game aisle of the Toys R Us in Rockville, Maryland, where I always went. And like, you know, they had the games hanging on pegs. They had the game systems you could play in those. It was kind of ozone was in the air. You're probably hurting yourself, but loving it. I don't know.
Yes. The outgassing from all those tires in the bike department.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, definitely. Yep, was that weird smell in there. They had like, there was like baby products too, so you had this kind of like powdery sort of smell to everything. Yes. If we could only live it again.
A whole generation of just childhood carcinogens breathing them in.
Yes.
Yeah, live it like again talcum? With a little less lead.
Things are going to be rough in about 10 years.
Talcum powder is like asbestos or something, isn't it? Now we know. Like back then it was just,
times,
you know.
Good times.
Yes.
So the West opened up, you know, the Japan opened up to Western companies, but at the same time, the Middle East closed to Japan, 1973's OPEC crisis. That affected the world. Lots of terrible things happening with gas exports suddenly becoming much scarcer and not making it to the rest of the world. Again, resonating with the present day. In this case, it was this was kind of blowback that was 25, 30 years in the making as OPEC, I can't remember what it stands for, but it's basically a coalition.
Oil producing
something
organization,
countries.
Yeah. Organization of Arab Petroleum Exporting Countries.
That was it. So basically, the major petroleum exporters in the Middle East. After World War II, the Brits and the Americans came in and said, great. Okay, thanks, guys. We're really powerful, and this gas is ours now. And they were basically claiming possession of the gas and getting imports to their countries, you know, the UK, US, UK, et cetera. For far less than the actual value. And after a while, OPEC nations were like, you know what? This is our resource. It's here that they're extracting from our countries.
Yep.
Why should we be giving it to them? Like, they should be paying us much better than they are. So basically they said, you know, hell no, we're not going to send it, and shut down exports, and gas prices spiked up worldwide, which had, you know, terrible effects everywhere, caused a massive recession around the world. But it hit Japan especially hard because something like 98% of petroleum is imported in Japan, yes. And most of it comes from the Middle East.
And they're making plastics.
Is the case for most of Asia.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Exactly. Actually, plastics is where this comes in, yeah.
I think this actually is even more relevant to modern times because the 1973 oil crisis was triggered by what's now known as the Yom Kippur War, which was a kind of sneak attack, or, you know, if, depending on how you define it, on Israel. And it resulted in this kind of big battle that was happening. And right now, our current oil crisis can be traced back to a similar attack that happened in Israel in 2023, the October terrorist attacks in Israel. And so this really is a kind of moment of where history is rhyming, if not exactly repeating. And it's interesting, the ripple effects of that 1973 oil crisis were felt like all over. Japanese toys famously started to be made differently, less plastics, more things like metal in them, which is, you know, as a kid, I loved die-cast robot toys, so this is kind of a good thing. Also, another really completely indirect sort of after effect of this was that in 1973, when the economy crashed in Israel after all of this, a lot of Israelis left and went looking for work in other places. One of them was a gentleman by the name of Haim Saban, who left Israel. Hmm. He was a concert promoter, and he brought the kid who he was promoting to France, and they began recording songs. And most famously, they started recording songs for anime shows. And Haim Saban's production of the French version of the theme song for UFO Robo-Grandizer was such a huge hit in France and all over Europe that he started to get a real war chest going on. And Haim would later go on to purchase the rights to and launch the Power Rangers. So, like, there's all of these sort of effects happening here that you could never predict, that are the ripples go decades out. Without the 1973 oil crisis, would Haim Saban have left Israel? Would he have started this anime craze in Europe? Would he have started a live action craze in the US? You know, and it's like war is bad and all of these things, but you can just never tell. This is a lot like when the government, you know, kicked Japanese kids out of arcades. They thought they would be making kids healthier, but in fact, kids started just burning out their brain cells at home on Nintendo, and Nintendo benefited from this. So it's like, you know, people think they're in charge, they think they're in control, and they almost never are. Or, you know, you can just look and know that these people aren't in charge or in control, as we kind of feel like today in many ways. But just some interesting threads there that I wanted to draw out. I said, mind's blown. Sorry, guys. Sorry. Just take a moment. Take a breath. Take a breath.
Heavy man. I don't like when history rhymes. I prefer free verse.
Yeah, me too.
Much less bleak just that
folk.
Way.
Folk, please. More like Pete. Make love, not war, please.
At the very least, could we have some dirty limericks from history?
Thank you.
Okay, so I feel like we've covered the major beats of Japanese technology and so forth that sort of laid the groundwork for the advent of the video games industry. It is, again, really important to... I just can't underscore enough how much, you know, the advent of the transistor and the rapid uptake and adoption of that across Japan, the rapid rise of manufacturing, and, you know, real, just a super heavy focus on technology, on silicon, on the components that led to computerization. Like, that became so essential to the video games industry as a whole. And, you know, you look at those one chip systems, you know, the Pong clones that all ran on the same kinds of chips, a lot of those were produced in Japan. You know, they were made in partnership, in you know, association between American corporations and Japanese corporations. And there was a lot of cross-pollinization of knowledge and information. And, you know, that continued to bolster kind of the base of expertise and skill that Japanese manufacturers had. And so you do have all these corporations really just building this kind of foundation for what would be video games. So I really feel like when you talk about the history of video games in Japan, you kind of start talking about hardware first as opposed to software. In America, you talk about, like, you know, computer space and Pong and things like that, Grand Track. But I feel like when you look at Japan, initially they weren't making, like, it wasn't software and game concepts that they were coming up with over there. They were giving people the ability to create these things. And certainly there was manufacturing and hardware design and engineering happening in the US, make no mistake. But the Japanese manufacturers just became so crucial to that. And, well, you know, they really built great advances in computing. You know, something you don't really hear about that much because so few Japanese computers actually left Japan. But there were tons of partnerships with French firms, American firms, Canadian firms, you know, just anyone who was serious about computers and didn't necessarily have the resources of, like, you know, GE or something.
Right.
Was over there making partnerships and making deals and arrangements and developing friendships with Japanese manufacturers. And it just made Japan and their manufacturing industry and their you know, the big corporations over there a fundamental, like, inextricable part of the rise of video games. It's just, like, it wouldn't happen without them.
They were providing, we think of platforms today in terms of apps, you know, streaming apps or platforms or, you know, social media platforms, whatever. But the original platforms were all physical. And, you know, we tend to think of Japanese gaming in terms of the fantasies, in terms of the IP and things like that. But echoing what you're saying, Jeremy, you know, without people like Masayuki Iwamura, who actually engineered the Famicom, or, you know, Gunpei Yokoi, who engineered the Game Boy, these were the original platforms. And, like, whether you know, look fondly back upon Yamauchi's ruling of the pipeline with an iron fist, like, forcing, you know, compelling other makers to basically pay tribute to him to get access to that platform. Is that a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Was this actually something that would have been illegal outside of Japan? Let's put all of that aside. These platforms were, like, in every home on the planet. It's amazing. Whether it was the Famicom, whether it was the, you know, later on thing, the 16-bit systems, whether it's the Game Boy. You know, what, karaoke is a platform, arguably. It's a platform for singing in your house. You know, somebody like, you know, the transistor radio arguably is a platform. Steve Wozniak talks about how when he listened to it as a little kid, he realized you could connect to the world using an electronic device. Now all of our experiences are mediated through software and apps and things like that. But they were, like, I think one of the reasons that we look back so fondly on Showa is because it was an era where you could hold those platforms in your hand. Literally, in the case of the Game Boy, and, like, you could see it. Oh, you plug it into the wall. You know what I mean? It's like, it was very there. It was very physical. Now we don't even, what does the internet look like? You know, it's like, what is it? We're interacting with this, like, miasma, and it sometimes it feels like it's poisoning us, maybe often, but that wasn't the case back in the Showa era with all of these things that we were playing with that were based on physical stuff. And, you know, arguably Japan kind of sort of lost the plot when Silicon Valley shifted the conversation from things to software, but it's a really interesting inflection point, not just for Japan, but the whole planet, really.
Yeah, it really goes back to the style of just basic play, and the fact that you had three giants. Well, you could probably argue that there were more than three amusement giants, but in particular in Japan, you had Michael Kogan of Taito, who made sure, who saw that there was something with these machines, something more than jukeboxes and pinball machines and things like that, and established a subsidiary in Yokohama called a Pacific Industrial for making his own products. David Rosen of Sega saw the same thing and started his own R&D division to make their own games. And Mr. Nakamura of Masaya Nakamura of Namco would do the exact same thing. These three guys, you know, they knew each other. They would actually, several of these guys, the heads of these video game companies would establish an organization to talk about industry issues, whether from a legal law standpoint or a copyright standpoint. Anything that might affect or harm their industry, they would get together, and not many people knew this, but these heads of early gaming would get together and talk about these issues.
The word you're looking for is cartel. Cartel. Seriously, I think that's the definition of it, really.
Yeah. Well, you know, I spoke with one former Sega executive who worked back in Tokyo in 1978. He's actually on an old NHK Japanese news clip, and he would have breakfast every weekend with Michael Kogan of Taito. So it was a guy from Sega and a guy from Taito having breakfast and just shooting the breeze about the industry. So it was surprising, but you have to give it to Michael Kogan of Taito, Nakamura of Namco, David Rosen of Sega, and you have Nintendo producing toys, of course, and board games. You had the foresight from these leaders of these Japanese game makers saying, "We have to bring together toy designers and electrical engineers, put them together." And let's see what we can make on our own that we don't have to import from America.
Yes, and actually, arguably, isn't Nintendo's suckitude at making video games entirely responsible for them coming up with the concept of, look, it doesn't have to be a programmer who's making the game? We can actually, like, hire this guy who's reshuffle around in the organization this guy who just happens to be good at drawing and coming up with ideas and have him design a game. Who am I talking about, people? What am I talking about? I think you know.
Is it Mario?
Miyamoto.
Are you talking about Mario?
Oh. I am talking about Miyamoto. Miyamoto, who's famously was swabbing toilets at Nintendo. No, I'm just kidding. I don't think he was doing that. But he was like in marketing or something. I think he was designing.
He was an industrial designer, I believe.
Yeah, and he wasn't a programmer. He wasn't like anybody who knew how to wire transistors together, right?
As I recall, Miyamoto was the guy responsible for the design of Nintendo's Blockazushi. Their breakout clone in the mid-70s. Like if you look it up, there's a very colorful, very very pleasant to look at console. I'm pretty sure Miyamoto designed that one.
Well, no, Miyamoto wouldn't have designed that, though. That has to be Uemura. Uemura is the actual engineer.
The console shell. So it originally shipped, and it was kind of just the sort of mundane thing, and then they had him sit down and redesign like the actual, you know, the exterior shell, but also it has kind of like, not instructions, but a display for the different play modes on it. Right. And he came up with this very simple, like, visual kind of symbology that represents each of the different play modes, like which colors and how many blocks and how many or balls and how many paddles and things like that. And it's very like intuitive. It's a very appealing device. So you can really see like the difference between the original Blockazushi and the Miyamoto version.
Right. No, that makes... Is it like intuitive, like the self-destruct system on the Nostromo in Alien, you know, where like Ripley is like, she's like reading these instructions and trying to figure out how to like
cursing,
blow up
yeah,
the...
Exactly.
No, but I just... That like was... Because Nintendo did not have a stock of the same sorts of experts that other companies... Back in time, like, you know, before Donkey Kong came out, if you were asking an industry expert who was going to be the next big thing in the 80s, they would have said Namco. They would have said Taito. They would not have said Nintendo. You know, Laser Clay had just died like a horrible death in the bowling alleys of the Japanese suburbs where I believe the Laser Clay systems were set up. So it's
they
just...
They made Laser Clay Mini.
Laser Clay. What, arguably, isn't the Nintendo Entertainment System Laser Clay Mini? Kind of.
No, there was actually a device called Laser Clay Mini. So when OPEC shock hit, when the OPEC shock hit, you know, they created Laser Clay to take advantage of the fact that there was this very brief fad for bowling in Japan, and as so many fads do in Japan, it was huge for a moment and then disappeared. But unlike many other fads, bowling leaves behind quite a footprint once you abandon. Yeah. The pastime. So there were all these empty bowling alleys and there were people who were like, what the hell do we do with the space now? So Nintendo said, hey, here's an opportunity, and kind of hermit crabbed it and created like a light gun based shooting gallery where it was kind of like going out in the woods and skeet shooting, except you were in a bowling alley that they had redecoed. But then, you know, that system was very large and very expensive and required a lot of plastic. And you know, the OPEC shock, one, all of a sudden plastic became much more expensive to manufacture, so they needed to miniaturize. But two, from what I understand, the Japanese government kind of said, hey, things are about to get really rough here, so you should really curb your spending and go into, you know, kind of austerity mode.
Luxury so is the enemy. Luxury
exactly,
is the enemy.
Collectively, yeah.
Well, I don't, you know,
Japan
if the
kind of moved away from going out to big events like that. So Nintendo created a compact version of Laser Clay that they could sell. And it actually had, from what I understand, like interchangeable cartridges where you could have different kind of play modes so they could kind of refresh it over time. So yes, there was actually a Laser Clay Mini.
I don't know that the government actually, I wonder, and I'm not actually, you know, disputing you on this. I can't imagine a situation where government says, hey guys, things are going to get shitty, because that like usually triggers some kind of panic. And actually there famously was a huge panic in Japan, right after in at that same time period, 1973, the toilet paper riots of 1973. They started in Osaka.
It's like the toilet paper riots of 2020 here in America.
They are like the toilet paper riots of 2020, started for the exact same reason. There was like a rumor going around that toilet paper was going to run out. And so families, housewives in particular, kind of besieged stores. And then when word of that started spreading to other cities, there were toilet paper riots in other cities. And then really ironically and famously, this became the punchline of a joke in America when Johnny Carson mentioned it. And the next day there was toilet paper riots in America because people thought, oh, if it's happening in Japan, it's going to happen here. It's actually probably the first true Japanese fad to make it big abroad is like overbuying of toilet paper. So, and that's all linked into this. You know, you couldn't shoot guns in bowling alleys anymore, but you could buy toilet paper.
I mean, I don't know for certain that the government said,
yeah,
things are going to get rough. It was probably just, you know, news reports coming in.
Right.
Just a general sort of vibe like, hey, we've got to tighten our belts.
Oh, people nested for
the
sure.
The way people are doing now.
Definitely.
No. If you look back a few years, I think, you know, certainly we in Japan, we had a very specific message from the top down of like, what was it? Jishutsu? What was the
expression? Jishaku. Right. Self-restraint.
Yeah.
And not in that kind of S&M way.
No. Yeah, it's like, hey.
There was Gekiga. Know,
this virus is out here, so don't go out as much. Don't travel as much.
Yeah. No cherry blossoms. There were no cherry blossom viewings for at least 2 years after 2020. Oh. They were canceled. And then, 2021 they were canceled. And 2022, it was a big deal.
My 2020 Hanami was me sitting on my veranda drinking a beer. That was my Hanami.
That's pretty much my Hanami every year. But Jeremy, I have to run. Ironically, the reason I have to run is I'm behind. I'm writing the script for a video game. How like ironic is this for a mutual friend of ours who I'll be able to speak and tell all when I can, but I'm really behind. I need to do this. So
video games giveth and they taketh away. I understand.
Yes, they do. So and you can keep that on there if you want. It's not like anything secret. But I hate to bail out while we're having such an awesome conversation. I love talking about Mario, toilet paper, you know, terrorist attacks, everything.
Yeah, well,
it's all good.
We'll do more of these. I'd like to keep the series going, and I'm sure you'll have lots of interesting things to add, lots of color commentary. So we'll definitely invite you back for Showa Era Part 2.
Well, thank you so
much. Thanks for your expertise. Before you go, do you want to tell people where they can find you on the internet and or buy your stuff?
Yes. Thanks for listening to me ramble. I'm Matt Ault. You can find my book, Pure Invention, anywhere books are sold. You can find, but if you are too cheap to do that, by all means, check out my newsletter, which is blog.pureinventionbook.com. I'm on Instagram, altmattault. Just look up combinations of Matt and Ault. You'll find me. Just like you find the key on your keyboard.
Very good. All right. Thanks, okay. Matt.
Thank you, Matt. And I'm going to bail out. Catch you later.
Bye.
Bye.
Later.
Bye-bye.
Okay, so actually that's a pretty convenient break into the final stretch of this, where I just kind of wanted to go over some of the companies that are integral. And like I said, you start with hardware first, because that is kind of the foundation of Japan's video games industry. And then later people started saying, oh, we can make our own games. We can come up with new stuff, new ideas. It doesn't just have to be, you know, Pong and Breakout. Crazy. And boy, did they ever. But, you know, when it came to the hardware, there's a surprising number. Like, I just kept going through lists and following links, and I kept coming up with new names. And I'm like, well, yes, of course. Why didn't I think of this company? There were pervasive. I've got a list here. Sony, Fujitsu, Sharp. I know it's not a Japanese-sounding name, but I promise Sharp is Japanese. NEC, Sword, S-O-R-D, no W, Hitachi, Fuji, Mitsubishi, Casio, Seiko, Canon. That's a lot of companies that were doing crazy things with transistors, doing amazing things with computers, helping to pave the way for video games to happen and to become basically the biggest and coolest thing ever. They were the, you know, I just really feel like the fundamentals, the baseline of technology that we rely on for video games, really, we owe much more to Japan than we do America. Like, the big ideas came from America, and then Japan was like, they would take it, run with it, make it smaller, faster, better, cheaper, and then bring it back to Americans who would say, oh my God, yes, let's team up. And so you kind of Voltroned it. It was awesome.
I was really
international partnership at its best. Kevin?
I was really trying to figure out, because there are a couple early like Japanese computer games or video game sort of things, and I was trying to figure out what hardware they were running on, because I'm sure it was at least one of these like mainframe or mini computers that one of these many companies were working
with.
Yeah,
like every single one of these companies, except maybe Sony, made their own mainframe computers or mini computers, which are not actually that many. It's a lie.
Listen, they fit inside a room, that's something.
But yeah, like all these companies were kind of tinkering with that. And then, you know, the really notable ones kind of branched out into different directions. Do you want to talk about any of those games really fast?
Yeah, real quick. So there's two of them that I've been able to turn up over the years. The first one from 1968 is a billiards game by Mamoru Hosuka and Seigo Sajiki. From the Tokyo University Aerospace Research Institute. They wrote this up in a Japanese journal at the time, I think Science Magazine. And it came up most relevantly in like the 1970s US patent arguments over video games. the Magnavox trials. But this was, this was a billiards game. It had, like, a screen. You controlled the angle. They were coming up with ideas and how, like, they could adjust, like, the friction and physics in fun ways. It was a big demo program for them. And the other one, this actually got a public demonstration at the Japan World Exposition in 1970. It was the train driving test. And this was basically Densha de Go with, like, a vector monitor. And you had to drive the train successfully. If you did it, they gave you, like, a little coin. They advertised this specifically as a game for kids to play. So it existed. I have never talked to anyone who has been to this, but there are, like, websites about it here and there on the Japanese web. So, like, people did. It had some traction.
Yeah, we're 2026, we just had another expo last year here in Osaka, 2025, and so the news cycle here in Japan has been dominated by both last year's expo, which means, of course, tons of stories about the previous expo in 1970, and of course, since I live here in Osaka, I can tell you that whole area is just a big park, and there's a mall there, and like it's still very relevant, even though the expo itself is long gone.
Is that Portopia?
I wish. That's Kobe, I think.
Well, yeah, Expo. I'm glad you guys brought up Expo 70 because Expo 70 had a huge influence on a lot of future game designers and programmers because there was this huge. Imagine visiting, going back in time and visiting Expo 70 because they had a huge coin operated game land amusement center. Which was like one of the 18 major attractions of this Expo 70. And one of the people, one famous game designer that recently talked about it, about his visit there when he was a child was Hideo Kojima of Metal Gear Solid fame. And how that visit, just seeing different things of the future being exhibited there and seeing so many different amusement games really influenced his decision to get into game making.
Wonder if he got the train coin.
I'm sure he would have blogged about it at some point. It'd be on his Twitter.
Yeah.
Okay. So Expo, very cool. I did not know about that. And I did not know about these early examples of Japanese video game design. The train one sounds like something that no one had ever created before that point, like genuine innovation, and also just like something that definitely came out of Japan.
Yeah.
where you've got the train spotters who put the British train spotters to shame. Also fewer drugs. So let's talk about these companies very briefly. We're going to kind of glide through this really fast because it's getting late and except for Diamond, and I don't want to keep any of you up too late. You've all got lives, families, friends, sleep schedules. So these are important. But I do want to talk about, these companies very briefly. Like Sony. Sony actually did not make video games in the 70s. They did not actually make video games in the 80s. They did publish them. That is a very important topic for Showa Era Part 2. But again, Sony, as kind of Matt discussed, with the innovations they made in transistors, the TR-55 transistor radio that was reliable, inexpensive, tiny, portable, and high quality, revolutionized portable electronics, like everything. And they took the money that they made off of the TR-55 and they just reinvested it into their own expertise. This was not Sony saying, hey, shareholders, you get everything and we're going to lay off all of our people who made this happen. This was like a company that was, serious about growth and evolution and development and becoming better. And wow, that's so refreshing. I miss those. So they invested into further miniaturization technologies. They invented, more music devices and just kept going, eventually giving us the CD and the UMD. Well, let's not talk about that. but also not just audio, but visual. Like they focused on televisions and created the aperture grid, giving us the Trinitron television, which was the standard for consumer televisions up until the point that CRTs went away. And even now, like any big, dumb, retro gaming dork worth his salt is going to have one, two, three, several Trinitrons stationed around their home. I think this Mac Classic that I just had refurbished also has a black and white Trinitron in it. So that would be four. Yeah, just within my line of sight. It's bad news, folks. Don't be me.
I love Sony Trinitron so much. I've kept two of them, so don't worry about it.
No, they're beautiful little, like the picture quality is so good. And that was something, you know, even if you didn't buy the PVMs or BVMs or whatever, just like a consumer level set, it was always going to be the best picture quality you could get. You know, I owned a 27 inch Sony before I moved away from where I lived and couldn't take it with me. And, you know, played tons of PS1 and PS2 games and N64 games on that. And it was Dreamcast. So good. So beautiful and crispy. And it was like a $300 set, you know, not bank breaking at all. So that's Sony. Any thoughts on Sony, friends?
I mean, I just have to say Walkman. We can't skip over the fact that their Walkman.
That was the 70s, wasn't it? 79?
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's post. Oh, that's after Space Invaders.
Yes. But it's worth pointing out just because, you know, if we talk about game-changing products that aren't games, like the Walkman was massive. And let's be honest, the Walkman led to the Game Boy. So mm-hmm.
That's true. It was the TR-55 of its era. Another company worth talking about, Fujitsu. They created Japan's first mainframe computer all the way back in 1954. So UNIVAC and ENIAC were what, like 52, 53? So they were
around there.
They were right there, just jumping in with this new technology and saying, let's figure this out too. And Fujitsu is also notable for being one of the very first electronics companies in Japan to partner with overseas firms to basically team up with computer software and distribution. So they would distribute their stuff overseas, other stuff would distribute to them in Japan. Very cool. Way to go, Fujitsu. Any thoughts on Fujitsu?
Mm.
No.
No.
Sharp is a big one. Matt touched briefly on Masayuki Uemura, but Sharp is the company that gave Uemura to Nintendo. He left Sharp, started up at Nintendo as an engineer, but he maintained friendships there. And those were crucial partnerships for Nintendo. You know, they basically, like, Sharp specialized in electronics, but especially tiny portable electronics with LCD screens. They created the world's first transistor-based calculator in 1964. They built the first calculator around microchips, integrated circuits, in 1966. And the first LSI-based calculator in 1969. So they were really going with LCDs, and then they did the cool thing. They did the thing that changed everything. They made a calculator with an LCD screen in 1973. And that was, it's hard. Like, it's one of those things where you're like, okay, yeah, a calculator, another calculator. It's got an LCD. You take that for granted. But Sharp's, you know, innovations and just great ideas with what to do with LCDs and turning the, you know, creating screens, like, that's so fundamental to so much of video gaming. Not just like Game Boy, which had an LCD screen, but things like Game & Watch and all those clones, those devices. I don't know how many hundreds and millions, maybe even billions of LCD screens Sharp has manufactured in its existence, but it's got to be vast and trackless as the sands on the ocean beach. That thing. Yes.
I don't just really make it be known. I'm just making it known that you can play Hayanko Alien on a Sharp Pocket calculator. Someone did make a version of that game, Hayanko Alien, for the Sharp Pocket calculator. But their manufacturing output you know, was massive, especially for Nintendo. Their chip making, if you open up a NES game, NES game cartridge, or any one of Super NES or NES, those chips came from a facility in Nara, Nara, Japan. And they were producing so many chips. Like many Japanese companies, they built dormitories next door, across the street from their manufacturing facilities to keep the chip making going nonstop, 24 hours in multiple shifts. And of course, Sharp would go on to make a number of Nintendo Famicom products in cooperation with Nintendo. Their relationship with the video game industry was very, very significant. And in fact, one of the things that I'm hoping to do one day is to visit the Sharp Museum in, you guessed it, Nara, Japan. Hmm. They have a bunch of artifacts that are right next to where they manufactured the chips for Nintendo cartridges.
That sounds awesome. In the museum. The Sharp Twin Famicom, which was an integrated Famicom system with a disk system. My understanding is that Sharp had a product called the Family Computer in the 1970s, and Nintendo just called their game system Family Computer, and Sharp came to them and said, like, guys, so as a make good, they said, you can create an officially licensed Famicom unit, which they did not let anyone else do. And so they created the Twin Famicom, which is the brightest and coolest of all the Famicoms. But that's not all that Sharp did. Sharp also created one of, if not the very first, Japanese home computer, the MZ, back in 1978. They also, I can't remember the guy's name, I forgot to write it down, but they basically invented the concept of CPU-based computing by taking all the different components that are required for, you know, like the registers and things like that for, you know, computing, and putting it onto a single chip. And they collaborated with Intel, and Intel took their schematics and their concepts and basically created the, what was it, the 8080 or whatever, the very first microchip.
Was it the 4000?
Kevin, you would know this.
Was it the 4004?
Yes, 4004. I was 2 times ahead of myself. yes, the 4004, I think, was it. But that was based on a concept that Sharp's engineers came up with. There was like a guy whose name I can't remember, and he bounced this idea off a woman whose name he can't remember. So it's just poor citations all the way down. But we can cite Sharp for so much greatness. Yes,
absolutely. Listeners, and for the screens and our Game Boys too, because mm-hmm, they made those mm-hmm. as well, and 3DS.
Mm-hmm.
Listeners, I just need to point out that during this episode, we have mentioned Zevius, Hey Uncle Alien, and the Portopia serial murder cases. So that's like a trifecta right there. That's a lot of bingo.
That's the sound. That's the sound you're going to hear from on Retronauts from now on when Zevius gets mentioned. Good times. All right, so there's also NEC. They'll become important during Showa Part 2. But they were a crucial provider of tech and a computer innovator. Their NEAC 1240 from 1968 was the world's first integrated chip-based computer. And they also did a lot of broadcast stuff, and I think that's actually kind of where their involvement in video games came from when Hudson teamed up with them. It was more on their broadcast stuff. I remember, you know, back in the day having NEC monitors on computers. They were just kind of a pervasive company. Let's see. I mentioned Sword earlier. They are largely forgotten. Had any of you heard of Sword before?
Heard of them, couldn't tell you what they made.
They made a computer that was basically an MSX or SG-1000. It was almost exactly the same. And it's notable, the M5, Sword M5, for having an early licensed version of Galaga. That's about all I know about Sword. But they were a big innovator in the 70s, and they just kind of went away. There's Hitachi, who created one of Japan's first home computers, the Basic Master. Not like the fancy masters that we get these days.
Did it run Basic? That's all I want to know.
I believe that is why it was called Basic Master.
I hope so.
That it could do one thing, but it did it really well. No jack of all trades here. Here's the computer that runs Basic. It is the master of Basic. Don't quote me on that, but that is my assumption. Fuji Computer created a mainframe called the Fujik in 1955. There's a bunch of other companies. I didn't even bother to write down their accomplishments. I mentioned them before: Mitsubishi, Casio, Seiko, Canon. Like all of these companies, if you've used electronics, you've heard of them. They are just integral to the, you know, the world of computing, electronics, consumer devices like copy machines and things like that, cameras, watches, et cetera, et cetera. Now we get into the companies that actually made the games and the game systems. And I feel like to talk about, we don't have to go too much depth into any of these because we've talked about all of them, I think. But to really have any discussion about pre-Space Invaders video games in Japan, you start with Epoch, because they were the company that really brought consumer video gaming to the home in Japan. And actually their very first device, TV Tennis Electro Tennis, in case you weren't sure what it does, it plays tennis. That actually reached the Japanese consumer market a few months before Atari's Home Pong. So they were in there. I mean, you know, the Magnavox Odyssey was already out there, but this was a dedicated device. It's the one Epoch system that I've never actually encountered in person, but it was like really wide and narrow. And a really cool shade of red.
It looks so cool.
Wow. Back when they made electronics that were cool and not just like a gray, black brick or whatever the hell PlayStation 5 is. I just got a PlayStation 5. I finally gave in since they were raising the price and finally bought a PlayStation 5. And I just, you know, I hate the design of that system so much. So I got the one that's Ghost of Yote. It looks like it's been kintsugi'd. So I'm like, yeah, this system looked busted from the start. So let's get one that looks like it's been repaired with gold filigree. That seems appropriate. Anyway, that's just me bitching about modern games. Back to talking about old video games. How much experience do all of you have with Epoch's games? Kevin, mm-hmm. I think you have quite a bit.
Yeah, I've played around with the Cassette Vision and Super Cassette Vision.
Oh, that's too far. That's too far. No, no, we're not to 1981 yet.
That's
true. We're still in the 1970s. I've got some Epoch systems that I'd be happy to send your way. I've got a beautifully preserved baseball. Like, you would not believe that this system was made in 1978. It's like the box is so clean. The system is pristine. It's just a beautiful little device, but unfortunately it plays a really bad version of TV baseball. However, in 1978, like, what were you going to do? I mean, that was TV baseball. Holy shit. You can play baseball on your TV. What is happening? Amazing. Revolutionary.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think we talked about this. Yeah. You can send that stuff over. That'd be great. I have played around with Epic Man. That's pretty cool. The little handheld.
Again, Showa Part 2.
Yeah, Showa Part 2. But like, TV Tennis, Electro Tennis is really cool. Like, it uses, like, a wireless RF signal, which would never fly in the U.S. with our regulation, but Japan.
Oh, man, I've got 70s. The Master System, the Sega Mark III, the remote system, and it's literally just shooting a beam of television broadcast across your living room. Like, your neighbors must have hated you so much. I've been in Japanese apartments. They are not well insulated. They are not secure devices. What do you call those? Faraday devices. No, sir. They are not a Faraday cage. They can't even keep in heat in the winter, let alone keep out someone broadcasting Alex Kidd at you. Nope.
You know, maybe your neighbors just want to see you play through Spellcaster. Have you thought about that?
Yeah, they're like, man, this kid, he can't get the combination of things right. He's never going to beat the final boss in Alex Kidd. What a loser. Your neighbors are all laughing at you.
Yeah. Epic's cool.
Now they make Sylvanian family toys.
And more TV baseball stuff.
Do they? No?
I mean, actually, no. It's not TV baseball. It's like their little, like, baseball board game kind of thing. It's like a physical device, but they still make those.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay. So they still make that.
Yes.
That's
still
crazy.
Popular.
Wow. Okay. Like a, it's yeah, like a little magnetic thing, to, right?
Yeah, from like the 60s or Done. Thereabouts. Yeah.
I've got to add that one of Data East's star game designers actually came from Epic. This is not really a known fact, so you're getting an exclusive. Mr. Yuji Gondo was a kind of like a toy board game designer who started out at Epic. And he would depart Epic for Data East, where he would go on to make Burger Time, Lock and Chase, and B-Wings, among other games. And he actually got his start at Epic. So it kind of goes back to kind of what we were talking about before, how toy designers and board game designers kind of would get their start at video game companies with no real video game design experience.
You know, Lock and Chase does have big Epoch energy, so I can see it.
Yeah.
So right after Epoch, you have Nintendo. They were also, you know, before the Famicom, they also got into home games. This was largely due in large part to the oil shock. They had to miniaturize and kept getting smaller and smaller until finally they created a laser clay system so tiny you could put it in your living room. But they changed the clay pellets, the pucks, to ducks. It's just like you add a little extra line under the D. No, you get rid of the extra little line under the P. That's right. And you get duck. That's how it worked. This is exactly how the creative process went. I've got it on good authority. They just erased that little line under puck and you got Duck Hunt. And, you know, all those toys and innovations, the light guns, Kosinju and things like that, those were foundational to Nintendo's console business. But before that, they were teaming up with, I forgot to write it down again. Was it Mitsubishi?
I believe you're correct. I believe it was Mitsubishi.
Yeah. So all those, like the TV, the color TV game, Blockazushi, etc., like the innards on those were manufactured by Mitsubishi, and then Nintendo created the shells. And, you know, handled the manufacturing, I believe, of the overall component and the distribution. So that was a collaboration. But they, you know, they extrapolated on that to create real video games. And sometimes you'll see in like a WarioWare game or something, some throwback to Nintendo's early self-contained units. They also had some arcade games. They didn't totally abandon the arcade. In 1978... around the time of Space Invaders, they created Computer Othello, which very unfortunate. It turned Othello into a thing, and I keep having to cover Othello games in my videos, and I'm very tired of it.
No worries.
Nintendo had not created Computer Othello.
Othello was already a thing before that. They were just riding the wave of Othello fever that Japan had in the 70s.
That's true. Everyone loves Othello, the game normally called Reversi.
It's just, you know, it's a simple game to learn, but it's a lifetime to master. You've got to ride the wave, man.
Come on, it has two rule changes that make it legally distinct from Reversi and therefore copyrightable.
Fantastic.
But my favorite part of Computer Othello is that, like, it came out right before Space Invaders did. So, like, yeah, this is a game that probably would have done really well in Japanese, like, amusement centers. It probably did okay. And then just got completely drowned out by all of these Invader games.
Yes, and deservedly so. Screw you, Othello. Go to hell. Okay, so Sega. Is that where we are now? Sega?
Yes.
Someone want to scream it?
Sega!
There you go. I knew it was going to be Diamond. So we talked about Sega. Actually, John talked about Sega already, how they got started in, you know, the electromechanical machines and servicing jukeboxes, not joysticks, and so on and so forth. But they released their first video arcade game way back in 1973. It was called Pongtron. It's not actually anything at all like Tron. It's just Pong. But they actually, I would say, in terms of the early, like the 1970s pre-Space Invaders arcade games coming out of Japan, I really feel like Sega was the innovator. Like, they were doing the most original things, the most creative, interesting things. I see someone added some notes here about something called Missile.
Yes. You mentioned they did a lot of, like, interesting and technologically fascinating and innovative stuff, and this does go back to, like, their electromechanical era. They had a game called Periscope, kind of ripped it off of Namco, as far as I'm aware.
They totally ripped it off.
Yeah, but this was, like, a really deluxe electromechanical shooting gallery game, with little, like, electronic sounds and model ships and everything. They sort of followed that up in 1969 with Missile, which had a rotating film strip that showed, like, these jet planes flying along in the backdrop, and you're firing your missiles at those, and depending on if there's a hit or not, it'll have, like, a little solenoid pop up for the explosion. It's very, like, God, what's the word I'm looking for?
Delicious.
Sure, we'll go with delicious. It's very,
I do love a delicious video game.
Interesting. It looks cool in a way that a lot of other games at the time did not look as cool. So it was actually a kind of a hit over here in the West, but Sega was a Japanese company at the time. It's a Japanese game. Pretty cool.
Yeah, I feel like Sega really didn't kind of come into their own until they teamed up with Gremlin, the American company from San Diego. And they kind of collaborated on some technology, and then just Sega just ran with it. They went hog wild and became the innovators that we know and love. But that is also Showa 2.
I got to throw out that fun fact that Sega of America distributed a Nintendo early, very early mid 1970s Nintendo arcade game, Wild Gunman, utilizing a light gun, shooting a light gun at a screen projecting 16 millimeter film. And That's a little fun fact for you that it's a game that is hard to find nowadays, but would, of course, be retitled and remade for the Nintendo Entertainment System. But fun fact, Nintendo and Sega once actually worked together on a licensing agreement to bring the old 16 millimeter light gun game Wild Gunman to American shores.
Well, and then after that, Nintendo distributed the Sega game Head On as Head On In. That's like the letter N, not Head On In. So they teamed up from time to time, but then Sega betrayed them by creating the SG-1000. Or maybe Nintendo betrayed Sega by creating the Famicom. I don't know. I guess it's all a matter of perspective. It's like Rashomon, but video games.
Okay. Whoever got to the finish line first. You know, it was Sega Wild Gunman and Sega Shooting Trainer. And, you know,
Sega got to the finish line with SG-1000 first.
Yeah.
They tapped out.
I like to peacefully look at it as they all inspired one another. So,
pals. All right. So Taito, John, you talked about how I totally forgot the guy's name.
Michael Kogan.
Yes. Michael Kogan. How he was doing cool stuff, making things, not actually making things, repairing things, but then that turned into making things. A very evolutionary process. That's a journey that so many like him took. Someone tossed something in here about the Crown 602.
Yes.
So was this that was, you, Kevin Bunch?
That was me again, because this has been coming up in my circles a bunch, because recently Taito issued this sort of like hunt for the Crown 602, like a surviving unit, because this was one of the first domestic crane games made in Japan, even though it's just ripping off an Italian design. But they were trying to see if they could find one. They could not. They found the 603, which was the successor, like, from the following year. But yeah, they got big off of these, like, crane games, then branched out into electromechanical, and then on to early video games.
Yeah. And that's where this journey is headed to. But John, please.
Taito has to be also credited for opening up some of the first Japanese arcades, game centers in the, I'm going to say it goes back to the the early 1960s, late 1950s. But both Taito and Sega were very instrumental in actually owning and operating game arcades in Japan, and bringing their games in, as well as their competitors' games from overseas, importing them. And they would do that with a number of partners. Sega would partner up with Toho Studios, and they operated game arcades in the Toho buildings next to the movie theaters. So it became a really big business, and it still is for Taito. Sega, unfortunately, sold theirs off, their game arcade business. But it's how you bring your games to the masses. Why rely on distributors and smaller arcades when you can bring them to the masses in your own game arcade game center?
Exactly. So eventually, after running all those arcades, Taito thought, well, maybe we should have some video games to put in here. Why don't we make our own? And they did. And they also made some pretty cool and innovative stuff, including Gunfight? Which one was the American one? Western Gun was the Japanese one, right?
Yeah, Western Gun's the Japanese one. Nishikado joint. He was also involved on Interceptor, which was pretty cool, which was also a Pong clone, their first like video game, whose name is escaping me. Was it TV Hockey, I think? Sounds right.
And, of course, Space Invaders, which is kind of the stopping point for this episode. There is a little coda here that Kevin added and I put in the wrong place. Space Invaders, like, we've had episodes on it. I don't know that we need to talk about it anymore, but it is kind of like the big turning point for Japan having a video games industry. Before Space Invaders, Japan had a lot of people making some video games and a lot of companies making the technology that made video games possible, but it didn't really have an industry to speak of. But once Space Invaders hit big, it really changed the shape of that business, really turned it into a business as opposed to a collection of people hoping to make some quick money off a, you know, fly-by-night trend. And so I really feel like the story of Japan's Showa-era video gaming kind of hits a natural breakpoint here because, you know, from 1978 through 1989, that might actually be multiple episodes right there. There's just so much happening. We're not going to go like super in depth about anything, I don't think, but we do want to talk about kind of the cultural trends and overall kind of beats of the video game business in Japan and how those things fit together. So we will do that again when next we convene. Who knows when that will be? This one's taken a year to pull together. I'm hoping it'll take less than that next time. I'm also hoping that there won't be more historic parallels between now and then, because I'm really freaking sick of those things. So anyway, the last little coda here, Kevin, please walk us through this thing you've added. It's something I've never actually heard of.
Sorry, Namco. You've been bumped out.
Oh, yeah, Namco. They didn't actually make an arcade game until 1978, so we can talk about them next time.
But no, the other one I had pegged on here is a game company very rarely known nowadays called Casco. K-A-S-C-O, not the same as Costco.
No. No budget glizzies for you, sorry.
Alas, but this was an early arcade powerhouse in Japan, founded in 1955 by Kenzo Furukawa. They mostly stuck to electromechanical games. Their big thing was driving and racing games. So they had like Mini Drive and 58, Indy 500, 68. These were both like really popular games in Japan. Indy 500 got exported to the US by Chicago Coin under the name Speedway. But, you know, relevant to the video game side of things is that they developed Japan's first color video game called Playtron. This was a collaboration with Victor around 1973. This was like going to be a game where you play as a whale and you're swimming around eating fish. They made two prototypes. These were full color. They weren't using like cellophane or anything. But ultimately, it got canceled because Furukawa wanted to stick to electromechanical. He thought video games were just a fad, not worth getting into. He was also wildly incorrect.
Whales don't eat fish. He knew it was scientifically inaccurate. He had to shut it down.
Maybe you were playing an orca. I don't know.
Okay, fair enough.
But yeah, so they sort of like continued along in the 70s, but after like the invader boom happened, they just sort of went away. But if you've ever seen the occasionally memed reseller ad for their game The Ninja Gun, where just a guy standing there with the game and it says the in big black letters, "Guns are back, bigger than ever, The Ninja Gun."
I've never seen that.
That is a Casco game.
Alright, so Casco. Never heard of them, never will. That's my promise to you. So thank you everyone and Matt for joining me. This was supposed to be like a, you know, 75 minute to 90 minute podcast, and yet we just kept going because there's a lot of interesting stuff here. We could probably do an entire podcast on any one facet of the multitude of things we've talked about tonight. Or this morning, as the case may be for you. So this was kind of a surface level view, but was really sort of meant to just provide a bigger picture context. Because the more I learn, I don't know, the more I learn about history, the more I'm like, oh, these other things make sense. So this was just kind of one of those periodic, like, let's kind of talk about the bigger picture kind of podcasts. And, you know, we can do these for... We talk a lot about, you know, kind of American history and how that impacts video games, but I could see us doing European history if assuming Stuart knows anything about his his own people's history. I can't guarantee anything. Anyway, this was a fun chat, and there will be a part two, and I would like to talk about Heisei video gaming also, because that's a whole thing.
In between the moment now and the moment in the future where we record Showa Part 2, I'd like to recommend two episodes that we did not that long ago that reference stuff that happened to this week. Number one, Kevin and I and Brian Clark and Matt Ault all did a Space Invaders episode last year, just about Space Invaders, but that, of course, talked about the lead-up to Space Invaders and the 70s and the 80s, which I feel like was a really fun time. I really recommend you go by that one. That was episode 681. It's available for free if you want it. And just as an aside, I know because Matt Ault brought it up, Matt Ault and I think Jeremy, I think it was just three of us, we did an episode about Gogo 13 and the Gekiga and that sort of, that
that's
whole phenomenon.
Been a while, yes. Yeah.
That was a few years ago when the author passed away, but that's also on our feed if you go back, look for Gogo 13 because that's a fascinating story about a man who just shoots really good and also has sex a lot.
It shoots really good in multiple ways.
Yes.
Yes. So, video games. Thank you once again for joining us. This is I believe this is a patron exclusive episode, which means, per usual, I don't need to badger everyone listening. Yes, that's correct. Don't need to badger you to give us money to donate because you already do. You support Retronauts and make episodes like this possible. You give me a reason to stay up until 10:30 on a Sunday night, even though I've got to get up at 6 o'clock to go to school, or by which I mean work. So thank you for giving me that motivation to stay up past my bedtime talking about video games. Diamond, where can we find you on the internet?
Well, most of my work is for Retronauts, but you can find me elsewhere on the internet by looking for Fight Club, F-E-I-T, that's my last name, C-L-U-B, that's a word you already know. I'm on social media as Fight Club, I write things as Fight Club, various video platforms as Fight Club, if you want to see my face while I talk for a change. Otherwise,
I can see your face right now.
Yeah, but you're lucky. You're lucky we have this exclusive connection. Also, if you're a patron, don't forget that I make columns for you, and I write them, and I do community shows. And some people say they don't listen to those shows because they can't keep up. They're there for you. You can always go back and listen to them. They're always there, and they're always immaculate. So just enjoy them.
Always the most modest of the Retronauts. John, where can we find you on this grand adventure that we call the internet?
You can find me on Blue Sky at John Anderson. That's Anderson spelled with an S-E-N at the end, at johnanderson.bsky.social or X, or on X at johnanderson21. And I link to some of the stuff that I'm up to on my Linktree, which you can find on either one of those social media platforms. And if I may, if any one of our Retronauts listeners has an electromechanical game from either Sega, Taito, Namco, aka Nakamura, that's electromechanical in their collection, in their garage, basement, attic, wherever, maybe consider tweeting out a picture to us at Retronauts and, you know, share it with all of us. We'd love to see, because those games are very hard to come by.
Sorry, Casco. No one cares about you.
Kevin, do you have any Taito EM machines in your basement?
No, I'll have to check.
The next chicken time coop, maybe.
Next time I'm crawling around under the house, I'll take a look. You can,
where can
find,
we find
me,
you online?
You can find me on Blue Sky at atariarchive.org. It's also my website. It's also the name of my YouTube channel and my book, which is available through Limited Run Games. If you want to learn more about the early history of video games, I have a lot of material in there all about, mostly the Western industry. But
basically the Western equivalent of this episode, honestly.
Yeah, but I'm using Atari as a jumping off point. So May that be your lodestone.
And finally, you can find me, Jeremy Parrish, here on Retronauts quite often. You can find me on my YouTube channel weekly talking about old video games. And you can find me at Limited Run Games doing a wide variety of things. I have recently published my first book through a real label, The History of Metroidvania. It's called Dark Horse Comics. Look it up and buy my book. And I also designed-ish a video game, Jaws Enhanced Edition, as part of Limited Run's Jaws Retro Edition. You can get that on PS5, Steam, and Switch, so I highly recommend that. It's very inexpensive, $15, and you get to play a game that I looked at Zelda 2 and East and said, what if Jaws were like those? And, you know, Westone did like half the lifting for me already, so it was very easy to just kind of, you know, tell the programmer, do this stuff. And he did, and it was awesome. So check those out. In the meantime, we'll be back on Monday with another episode that people can listen to on the free feed. And we'll be back in two more weeks. That's right. For another episode that only you can listen to. Thank you for your support. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.